anything but. And what Trump has done with the chaos in Iran is he's pretty much guaranteed a global recession by destroying energy resources and particularly also other essential inputs for the manufacturing systems we all rely upon, most essentially fertilizer and helium and sulfuric acid. Those are the three major things which he's stuffed up in addition to oil. In about a month or less, because we'll start running out of helium. Okay.
And so what are the consequences of that?
No more microchips.
What does that mean?
No more AI. No more computers.
So no more new computers being made, or
no more new computers being made. Okay, in December 2005. There's reasons for the timing, which is circumstantial, but that's when I started looking at it. And what I argued was that this is the ratio of private debt to GDP. So I said this growth in the ratio cannot continue. At some point, the ratio has to start falling. And when it does, rather than this being a positive slope, we're going to find this being a negative slope going down. And that means that credit, which is the annual change in private debt, rather than adding to demand, will start subtracting from demand, and that'll cause the crisis.
Welcome, everybody. This is just Steve Yang here with Natural Resource Stocks, where we mine for stories that matter. And today I've got a guest with me. I'm joined today by Professor Steve Keen, economist and author who foresaw the 2008 financial crisis. There's a lot happening right now, and I'm eager to get your perspective, Steve. Thanks for joining. How are you today?
Very good. Well, as good as anybody can be after the crazy night we all had wondering whether we're going to wake up to nuclear Armageddon or not. But yeah, I'm fine.
other than the end of the world.
Other than the end of the world, how was the play, Mr. Lincoln? It's that sort of world we're in right now.
Well, Professor Steve Keen, thanks for being here. Steve, I'm with the markets turning optimistic in the last, let's say 12, 24 hours, after the U.S.-Iran ceasefire. If you strip away the headlines, does the global economy actually look stable to you, or is it just volatility
anything but. And what Trump has done with the chaos in Iran is he's pretty much guaranteed a global recession by destroying energy resources and particularly also other essential inputs for the manufacturing systems we all rely upon, most essentially fertilizer and helium and sulfuric acid. Those are the three major things which he's stuffed up in addition to oil. But all of them coming at once is going to be a shock that we, in that sense, he's quite right to say this has never been seen before. He's finally done something unique.
All right. So you mentioned the fertilizer and other things. Can you expound on that for people like me who aren't as informed and aware of what's going on?
Well, firstly, my specialty is not material science, but I have friends who work in material science, which is where I've learned these details from. A guy you should talk to as well is a guy called Craig Tyndale. Craig's active on Twitter, very good friend of mine, and has excellent background in resource availability. What he and many others have pointed out, that it isn't just oil that goes through the Strait of Hormuz. It's also absolutely critical inputs to our production system, which are byproducts from mining oil. So one of the most obvious ones is fertilizer, because we use chemical processes like the Haber-Bosch. There are other processes as well. Fix nitrogen and fix phosphate, and to enable them to be used as fertilizers all around the world. Now, something of the order of 30% of the world's fertilizer passes through the Strait of Hormuz. And there are some countries which have enormous reserves of fertilizer. Apparently that applies to China, does not apply to India, does not apply to Australia, doesn't apply to the UK, a whole range of different countries. So they're reliant upon that stream of fertilizer turning up over time. They have stocks, of course, for each of the forthcoming seasons. You don't use fertilizer until the growing season comes along. But we've had at least a one-month interruption. And we've also had destruction of some of the facilities that produce those fertilizers. So there's going to be a one-month hole in deliveries, which will be hitting supplies in the next month or two, because it takes, you know, an enormous length of time for those things to be shipped from the Persian Gulf. I saw a very nice little illustration making the point that a super tanker moves at about the speed of a person doing a slow bicycle ride. So if you imagine doing a slow bicycle ride from the Persian Gulf to Sydney, that's how long it's going to be before Australia starts getting fertilizer on the, and they rely upon that continuously being updated. We've now got a 1 month hole in the middle. We've got something of the order of, it's hard to estimate, because we, you know, there's so many untruths about this war. We really don't know the overall dimensions, but something of the order of 10% of the fertilizer production capability has been destroyed. As well as this hole in the delivery because of the closure of the Straits of Hormuz since this conflict began. Now, that means that we are incredibly dependent upon fertilizer for agricultural yield. So without superphosphate and nitrogenous fertilizers, the estimates are that the carrying capacity of the planet with standard farming techniques is between 1 and 2 billion people. Now, that means we've jeopardized the food for 6 billion people out of this crisis, because if the fertilizer doesn't arrive in time, you know, you've got to make it in the growing season. If you're not there for the couple of weeks that's necessary to mix the two together, then you might as well not turn up at all. And some countries overuse fertilizer. Apparently, America is in that situation. Some countries have their own source of fertilizer. That's also including America. But a lot of the world uses fertilizer to get the maximum possible yield. And if that falls back, then so does the yield, and it's quite a dramatic fall. So the odds are various countries around the world, not just the usual suspects of India and Africa, are likely to suffer a famine. And like, for example, how extreme this could be, and this also goes with the fuel story, Australia could suffer a famine. Okay. Now, that's the last country on the planet you normally associate with famines, because it exports six times as much food as it consumes. But if the fertilizer is not there, then you can't grow the food in the first instance. So that's going to hit production. And you've got to have diesel to move the fuel from where it's grown to where it's either consumed or exported. And diesel, in Australia's case, incompetent governments, plural, all the Australian governments for the last 10, 15 years, have neglected having sufficient reserves of fuel. So Australia is supposed to have 90 days. That's the standard set by the International Energy Association. Australia has 30 days. So it means within the time gap that actually exists in the flow of fuel and from the Middle East, Australia could run out of fuel. And then that happens.
Wow.
That means you can grow the food if you get the fertilizer, but you can't necessarily ship it to where, from where it's grown to where it's eaten. So this is something we've never experienced before on this scale. And that implies the possibility of famines in various locations around the world, depending on how much of a buffer those countries have and how much they produce of their own. So this is just unprecedented. And in that particular case, yes, Trump has done something original. Congratulations, Donald. Okay. Another one is...
There's a couple of others.
Well, let's chat and I'll come back to the others as well. Yeah.
Well, yeah. So first of all, we're assuming that the two week ceasefire is going to stay at 2 weeks.
This is another pump and dump scheme by Trump, quite possibly. I think he's also backed into a corner, but yeah, it'll be on again.
So is this something where you can, you know, when you turn off the faucet and you turn it back on, it takes a while to ramp back up to where it was before? And we talked about a month gap or a month behind, and you were just starting to talk about the ripple of, you know, what this could look at. And we just talked about fertilizer and just the impact that this can have. Are the markets feeling it already? Have they accounted for?
Nowhere near enough. I mean, it's not just the price, it's the physical availability.
Do you think the current administration?
Yeah.
Okay.
Do I think the current, we're getting a bit of a time lag here, but you asked me.
Does the current administration, someone must be ringing the alarm bells. The current administration must know what's.
I'm afraid they're generally speaking clueless. And so when you look at what's happening, I mean, we get reports on how things are decided in Trump's circles. He doesn't read a book, okay? He doesn't read written material. He goes in his gut feeling. And like the story, which is becoming more and more verified, is that there was a briefing which Netanyahu was at in the briefing room, and he really pushed hard the idea this will be a short, sharp war and you can get publicity out of it. That's the positive for Trump. I'd like to know what he's got, Netanyahu's got over Trump in terms of negatives to get him to do what he wants to do. But the army people saying, look, don't do it, don't do it, don't do it. And Trump's, oh, my gut feeling tells me it'll work. And the Venezuela success went to his head as well. So he thought this would be over in a few days. And there's no consideration of what the physical impacts are upon the real economy in that process. Now, there would have been some people inside aware of it. As it happens, a good friend of mine who's an expert in this area, Craig Tyndale, has recently had his feed discovered by the White House. So some people in the White House would have been getting that information. But it was probably in the middle of this whole conflict before they actually realized it. And of course, how do you tell Trump he's made a mistake? You can't. Just his psychology would explode. So nobody dares tell him that he's made a mistake and that he continues making those mistakes without the background. So I think all these physical shocks that are occurring to the production system are catching people like Trump and the top echelons of the White House, including Hegseth, whom I prefer to refer to as Hog's Breath, but that's just me. They have no awareness of this, and it's just sheer confidence and bravado behind this whole excursion.
So, first of all, I don't even know what this war is about, to be honest. I don't know why we're involved.
There's no justification whatsoever. I mean, apparently Iran was actually signing an agreement, which was going to say they'd actually have their uranium stored offshore, full monitoring, a whole range of really sensible concessions by the Iranians, and the next day, well, just after the agreement had almost been signed, Trump and Netanyahu assassinated all the people they'd been dealing with.
I'm sure when all the dust settles or whatever that looks like, I'm sure the aftermath is going to be more than just an easy dust settle. But like after the dust settles, I'm sure the narrative is going to be this was a successful excursion. We gain X, Y, Z. There's going to be some sort of spin that, certain good things were done. Like what things could they possibly say to justify the war? I'm trying to give the benefit of the doubt. What might they say? What's the justification?
There's nothing of sense that can be said about it. I mean, if he'd actually continued with the negotiations and signed off on the deals that the Iranians agreed to before he bombed the hell out of them and killed their leaders, then that would have been something to brag about, because it would have been, okay, we've ended the Iranian nuclear threat. They're going to store their nuclear materials off country so we can all see what they've got. We know it's not being used for weapons. A whole range of other, really quite intelligent concessions by the Iranians. And you can tell, I mean, one thing we've seen by watching the media on this front, if you want to see intelligent commentary, you watch the Iranians. You don't watch the Americans. It's frankly embarrassing to compare people like Hegseth to the people who are speaking on behalf of the Iranians. It's just ridiculous how different the intelligence is. So if they'd stuck with that agreement, there'd be something positive. Otherwise, it's completely negative. And I don't think it's going to stop the war, by the way. I think Iran said that they're not stopping. They may be willing, if Trump keeps his side of the bargain, which is highly unlikely, and if Netanyahu doesn't break what he's supposed to agree to, which is also highly unlikely, then maybe Iran will stop. But it looks like at the moment, like as we're speaking, it appears that Israel is bombing Beirut. And one part of the terms that allegedly the Trump claims he made the Iranians concede to, he's put forward claims that Iranians made 5 days ago and called them his own terms. That's what he's done. But that included the bombing of Lebanon had to stop. Now the Israelis are doing it straight away. So I think what we're going to see immediately is that the conflict will now continue between Iran and Israel, and it'll be over both the bombing of Beirut, and the Iranians will continue trying to inflict serious damage on Israel until such time as Israel stops, well, if it does, probably won't stop the attack on Lebanon. And if Trump does back out and doesn't actually help the Israelis for a couple of weeks, then they could be really exposed to heavy barrage. So I don't think this is over by any means.
So, you know, I like playing chess. And one of the things in chess is I like anticipating the moves and getting inside someone's head. What is going on in President Trump's head? What's the objective here?
Well, President Trump is a malignant narcissist. Okay, let's just get that straight. There's no way you can understand his behavior by thinking like a normal human being. You have to think like somebody who's got that disease, okay? And like I had a relationship with a woman who had that disease. So I think the one lasting benefit of that relationship is I understand Trump. Okay? I made a comment on one of my YouTube videos. And people always say, look, Keen, you're an economist, you're not a psychologist. What are you doing trying to diagnose Trump? And as it happens, three clinical psychologists wrote comments saying you absolutely nailed what the Sinone syndrome is and his behavior. So, for example, we all think that Trump is trying to bullshit us when he lies about something. He's not. He's trying to bullshit himself. Okay. He wants to get an explanation that means he's never made a mistake. That's a critical thing for somebody with this disability. So a person with narcissistic personality disorder has to believe that they're always right. They never make a mistake. Okay. Now, if they do make a mistake, what they've got to do is rewrite history. So what happened historically didn't happen. Something else did, which makes the current situation that they're in a success. And that's what he's doing right now.
So you're telling me that he actually believes the words that are coming out of his mouth?
It's getting a story that takes away the anxiety he feels internally about knowing he's full of crap. Okay, that's the. I mean, look, I'll give you my massive anecdote from my own relationship to put this in perspective, because only having experienced this do I have any idea how these minds actually work. So, short version of the story, as with meeting with my then partner, female, and two other women, and one of them made a comment saying that I looked like I slept with a vampire because I had some welts on my neck. And the one thing about the people with this disease, they alienate virtually everybody else. Anybody they see as a competitor, all the women hated her. So I thought, I've got to neutralize this. And I said, oh, she's not a vampire. She's a vamp. Okay. And then she instantly said, how dare you call me a slut in front of these women, Steve? I'm grossly offended. That's how she said offended. So I just, you know, anyway, sometime later we were discussing it. And like, because she doesn't speak English as a first language, I said, well, did you, when I said the word vamp, did you translate it to something like prostitute? And she said, yes, I did, Steve. That's what I did. And I said, but it doesn't mean that. See, that's what I learnt it meant. Look, I'll go and show you. I'll show you my dictionary. So she went and grabbed a copy of the English language dictionary, turned it open to the word, to the V's, and vamp, you know, virtually the first word. And vamp, the definition of vamp, and this that she supposed she learned it from, was the definition was sophisticated and irresistible woman. Okay? Exactly the meaning that I meant. Now, she didn't say a damn thing. So this is, you know, lunchtime, and we went out for dinner that night. I thought, I'm going to get an apology out of this bitch if it kills me. So I went to raise that event, and what she said, and this is a direct quote, and I'll try to get the facial expression as well. Yes, Steve, and the other women we were talking to weren't attractive enough to be vamps, and I was offended on their behalf. Now, I was there, okay? I knew what happened. It wasn't she was trying to persuade me, trying to make her own behavior in the past consistent with her behavior today. So she was offended for these women that I said weren't attractive enough. You know, and then therefore I'm at fault, she's not. Now, that's the mentality of somebody who suffers from this disease. So Trump, anything that happens, if he makes a total stuff up or something, and he does that all the time, he has to say it was actually a strategy. Four-dimensional chess, to use, you know, that analogy. And that's what he'll do. So everything you get out of him is not him trying to persuade you. It's him trying to convince himself that he hasn't made a mistake.
All right, so... Right, all interesting, Steve. I do want to go back to the fertilizer part.
Of course, let's go right now. Helium, sulfur dioxide, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. Tell me more about that, because like all we're hearing about is the oil.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, when is it going to be
the narrative is going to go from, hey, this is a lot worse than we, you know, when's it going to go to, this is a lot worse than we thought it was. Here's the fertilizer. And
in about a month or less, because we'll start running out of helium. Okay.
And so what are the consequences of that?
No more microchips.
What does that mean?
No more AI. No more computers.
So no more new computers being made, or
no more new computers being made. It's like what's happened as part of the war as well. It is that there are two of 14 components that are necessary to extract helium from liquid natural gas. So the helium, you know, how's your chemical knowledge?
You know, I'm not a chemistry guy. I didn't do well. I was in AP chemistry, but didn't do well.
Helium is the second lightest element, and it's inert. Okay, and it therefore means you can use it in things like cooling facilities, because you can cool it down to virtually absolute zero, which is necessary for the production processes of microchips. It's necessary for MRI machines. It's necessary for a whole range of machines we use to calibrate production processes in so many different industries. And I don't know the exact numbers. This is where Craig will be far better than me, but something of the order of 30% of the world's helium comes through that strait. And like 60 to 70% of Taiwan's consumption comes through that strait. Now, that means Taiwan, with the helium, we've got like if we're lucky, about a 10% fall in helium production, if we're lucky. And to get those, the processes to extract the helium have to turn it into a liquid, fundamentally free, absolutely, you know, cryogenically frozen. And those machines, there are five companies on the planet that can make the machines that do it, and they're an incredibly intricate production process. Most of them reckon it to take them 5 years to rebuild those facilities. So we've had something like, you know, say 10, 20% fall in global helium production. And that means that we just simply can't produce as many microchips. We can still produce some, but there are other manufacturing processes where you need the helium now, and you need it's going to take priority over the microchips. So there's all sorts of consequences flowing from that. Another one is that hydrogen sulfide, you know, rotten egg gas, okay, that's a byproduct of you know, getting natural gas out of the ground. And the sulfide, hydrogen sulfide, is used to produce sulfuric acid. Now, sulfuric acid, pardon me, I've got some doing really construction, if you can hear the noise in the background there. Sorry about that. So hydrogen, sulfuric acid is necessary. Oh, good, I'm glad. Sulfuric acid is necessary for refining copper. Many, many other processes use sulfuric acid. So we've lost a substantial proportion of the sulfuric acid needed for the world as well. So there's three, fertilizer, oil, natural gas, sulfuric acid, and helium. They're all massively affected by this conflict. And with them, it means that, as I said, in terms of microprocessor production, this is going to take us 5 years to recover from, if we recover from it. The sulfuric acid.
5 years.
5 years.
For being a month behind.
Yeah. Well, not that it was a month behind, because two of the 14 huge devices, they call them trains, they have to freeze the helium down, because, like, as the second lightest element and inert, you've got to get it almost to absolute zero to make it compressed of liquid effectively. That can't be done by the standard processes that apply to freezing other, like freezing oxygen down to, you know, absolutely. You see frozen, cryogenically cooled oxygen as part of the launch process for rockets, obviously. You've got to have cryogenically frozen oxygen for Elon Musk's rockets and so on and so forth. But you can do that, most of these processes, you can do it by an expansion process. So if you compress something, it gets warmer. You expand it, it gets cooler. That works for most gases. It doesn't work for helium. So there's incredibly intricate, and I'm not an expert on this. This is going from what my colleagues have told me. Incredibly intricate machines, which use a massive use of aluminium, apparently, in very intricate. I definitely don't know the technique, but to get it like from 250 to 270 degrees Celsius, degrees below zero, then you've got to have these special devices. And there are 14 of them in a particular complex, which was attacked by Iran in a retaliation for America's and Israel's attacks on them. And that's 1/7 of that facility is gone, and it'll take 5 years to replace it.
What do people get wrong in about how the economy really works here?
Well, people have been informed by conventional economics about how the economy works. And that's a complete and absolute myth. Okay. All the stuff that people learn at business school, all the stuff taught by mainstream economics, it's all garbage. There's a great American humorist you might know called Menshkin, who wrote back in the 1920s, and he said there's a simple solution. Every human problem has a simple solution, which is neat, plausible, and wrong. Okay, now that's actually the state of mainstream economics. The supply and demand curves, they're myths. They don't exist. And also, when you draw them, you know, just a couple of intersecting lines, and people think they understand markets. That's the nature of conventional. Yeah. Economic education, you don't learn about the physical production process that are involved. The models of production they use involve, imagine you can produce output by combining labor and capital with no raw materials inputs. So people aren't educated to understand the dependence of the production system upon raw materials and energy. And therefore, when we get shocks to raw materials and energy, they're not even, there's nothing in their background education that tells them that's going to be a problem. So that's, I blame conventional economics for how blind we are about the damage this crisis has done. Not just Trump, but Trump's pulled the trigger. But the fact that the trigger is going to kill us is hidden from us by conventional economics, which leaves out the dependence of the economy on raw material inputs and energy. I know that's a shock, but it's true.
You paint quite the picture. So where do things go from here? I mean, right now it's April 8th. The markets haven't felt the ripple effect that's coming. The war is far from over, it seems.
Yep.
There's got to be smart people from other countries going, hey, we have a huge issue here. The alarm bell's ringing. Media eventually catches on. Like, when do the markets catch up? And, you know, like, does the war continue? I'm like, okay, you can't get in the mind of Donald Trump and the current administration, but
no.
Like, let's try to get in the minds of the other world leaders. I mean, where do, like, I can't.
People just let
things go the way they're going.
They're equally misinformed. Again, because they're all relying upon mainstream economics. I mean, virtually every leader has done something in economics. I think probably even Trump has done something. So that what their minds go back to, what they learned in first year, when it's supply and demand curves and production, labor and capital giving you output. They're not preconditioned to understand it. The only way they can understand it, they talk to somebody, not an economist. Okay, I call myself an anti-economist socially for good reason. Okay, but they talk. They've got to talk to somebody in the industry portfolio who's not an economist, who knows the actual production processes. Have you heard of things that are called sand key diagrams? Have you heard of what's called a sand key diagram?
No. Okay. No. Do you have a diagram you can show me?
I don't have one on the screen at the moment, but if you search for it, you'll find it and insert it in. A sand key diagram shows the flows of different resources through different uses. So you can have a sand key diagram for oil, one for plastics, one for wood, et cetera, and you see where all these things go. Now, that's commonplace in engineering, and it's commonplace in management to some extent to see those things. Economists don't even think about them. They leave them out. So if your background is a first year economics, you're completely unprepared to interpret what's happening right now.
So can you tell me what's happening right now and where do things
we're
go?
We're going to lose something of the order of 10 to 20% of global energy, and that'll mean about a 10 to 20% fall in global economic output. And that's the good news. Okay.
That's the good news.
That's the good news, because I'm only talking about unavailability of energy. There's also unavailability of fertilizer, which means we affect food supplies, unavailability of helium, as I've mentioned, which means you can't do enormous amounts of almost everything in high tech involves helium. Okay, so the high tech part of the industry is going to suffer very badly. And then almost all manufacturing processes at some stage involve sulfuric acid. you know, you would have played with that as a kid in a school experiment somewhere. You know what it can do. Well, it's essential for so many refining processes to burn off the stuff you don't want and leave you with what you want. Well, if you can't do it, you've got raw materials. You can't turn them into products. So that means there's going to be a fall in supply. It's not just a case of a time lag of some sort. It's a literal fall in supply, which means that no matter what price you pay for something, you still can't produce what you used to be able to produce beforehand. And this is again where the textbook thinking with its intersecting supply and demand curves imagines you can move the demand curve and get to a higher level of supply, you know, or the supply curve moves. It's easy, instantaneous change. It doesn't, as I mentioned in the case of those helium extractors, converters. You wait. If you want to move from a certain level of helium supply to a higher level, you've got to build something that'll take you 5 years to build. So the whole idea that there's easy adjustments is built into our minds from just being swallowing conventional economic theory, and it couldn't be more wrong about the way the real world actually operates.
So, Professor Keane, my understanding is that you were pretty early in calling the 2008 crisis. What did you see at the time that others missed, and do you see similar patterns building today?
Not this time around. I mean, I've been saying ever since 2014 that I didn't expect a credit crunch again like we had back in 2008. So I warned of the crisis in 2008. My next book after that was written in 2017 and called Can We Avoid Another Financial Crisis? And my basic argument was we're in the aftermath to a crisis. We still haven't reset the system enough to get back to another crisis again. So we're going to have, we had to reset the clock, and we hadn't. So we're still in the aftermath of what happened in 2008. And that means that what I was looking at, and this might sound ridiculous, the level of private debt and its rate of change. Okay, those are the two things I was looking at. So conventional economists look at the level of government debt and its rate of change. And that's how they think they predict crises. They're completely wrong. They scare us about future crises. That's what they do. I look at the level of private debt. I can actually show you that on screen if that would help.
Yeah, please.
Okay. So I'll just actually get the right one of my sets of slides up here. And just, okay, so let's, this is my, I'll just see if this, share the screen here. Okay. So this is my software, Revel. You can see it turning up now?
Not yet, but it's coming.
Okay.
There he goes.
Okay, so this is the level of private debt and government debt in America. And let's zoom in so you can see the debt levels more clearly. And all the conventional economists worry about this one. This is government debt to GDP. Okay, I worry about this one, private debt to GDP. Now, for starters, it's bigger. Did you expect that? That private debt is much higher than government debt? Okay, this shows the extent to which you have blinkers on your eyes without even being aware they're there, because your training tells you worry about government debt. Okay. It doesn't tell you.
Yeah.
It basically says ignore private debt. Now, I started warning at the crisis about here, okay, in December 2005. There's reasons for the timing, which is circumstantial, but that's when I started looking at it. And what I argued was that this is the ratio of private debt to GDP. So I said this growth in the ratio cannot continue. At some point, the ratio has to start falling. And when it does, rather than this being a positive slope, we're going to find this being a negative slope going down. And that means that credit, which is the annual change in private debt, rather than adding to demand, will start subtracting from demand, and that'll cause the crisis. Now, that's the level of private debt there. This is the rate of change of private debt, which is the black line. Okay. So I was looking at this and saying this simply can't continue. At some point, it has to turn around. Now, that is, I'm trying to get my little indicator turning up here, but that's about 2006, about October 2006. So the level of credit, which is the annual change in private debt, peaked at just over 15% of GDP back in the middle of 2006. And I've said it's expected to going to go zero and below. What you see is the level of credit debt went from being credit, new private debt, went from being over 15% of GDP to just above minus 5% over the next 3 years. So that meant that at this stage, and I'll explain the logic if necessary, private debt adds to aggregate, new change in private debt adds to income and expenditure. because when you borrow money, you don't borrow for the sheer pleasure of being in debt. You borrow to spend. Okay. When you borrow off the banks, that creates new money. Mainstream economics completely ignores that. They deliberately do not understand the banking system, so they can't even see this coming. But the extra borrowing you do expands demand. So when you use your income to pay off debt, you reduce demand. So that's a 20% of GDP turnaround in economic activity. Now, according to conventional economists like Ben Bernanke, he literally said this should have no significant macroeconomic effects. The other line I'm showing you there is the red line. That's the unemployment rate. I think you can see when one goes up, the other goes down and vice versa. They're almost perfectly negatively correlated. And the reason, and when I look at the correlation between the two, and this is between, just looking now between 2000 and, I've been 1990, the last major recession, and then 2015, you can see they're virtually mirror images of each other. So when credit goes up, unemployment goes down, and the correlation is minus 0.9. which is huge. Okay. On the other hand, the government goes in the opposite direction. Government spending rises when unemployment rises because less tax receipts coming in and more spending done by the government. So the government is a stabilizing force here. The destabilizing force is the level of credit. Now, you can see that credit, which is the black line, is now running at about 5% of GDP, or at this stage, at the end of the stage, 5% of GDP. But it'll never get back to the 15% level again. So I saw the crisis coming because I focused on this. I'd say that the crisis is not going to happen for the same causes, because when you look at the level, and this is now over the longer term over here, when you look at the level of private debt, we've only fallen from a peak of 170% in America's case to 140%. Okay. So it's still a huge overhang of private debt. That means that banks aren't all that willing to lend, and households and firms aren't that willing to borrow. So your credit demand is quite stagnant. So we got credit peaking at 15% of GDP here, which is too high, given how America uses credit. It's now down to about 3% of GDP. And given what we're going through, it may well go negative. So in fact, in that case, the stabilizing force is what the government does. So government spending, which has got to be extremely high during COVID, is now rising again. So even though Trump is smashing the economy with what he's doing to physical output and so on, he's actually going to add extra monetary demand this year, talking about an extra $500 million on defense spending and all that sort of garbage. But basically I don't see a financial crisis, but that's why I saw the crisis coming. I focus upon the level of private debt. Now, the mainstream completely ignore it, and they still haven't looked at it after the crisis. They will not consider that this is a factor that causes crises.
What do you see the mainstream missing today that if you were to go give us the Dr. Keene alarm bells, where are you blinking the neon lights?
Well, the main one I'm worrying about now is actual global warming.
Really?
Okay. Now I'm going to get you. Do you think global warming is real or do you think it's a hoax?
I mixed them on it. I mean, my understanding is that it's real, but it's happening at a slower pace than the people are talking about. But you seem to think it's happening a lot faster. If you can,
I do. And this, again, economists are responsible. So William Nordhaus was given the Nobel Prize for his work on climate change in 2018. He argued that 3 degrees of global warming, which is about twice where we've got to right now, 3 degrees of global warming by 2100 would reduce GDP in 2100 by at most 2 or 3%, 2 to 3. So rather than, let's say you use index numbers and say GDP in now is say like it's 100, and if there was going to be no global warming at all, then in 2100 it'd be 1,000. So you go from 100 to 1,000. He said you're going to go from 100 to 970. Okay, so 3 degrees of warming will take 3% off GDP in 2100, which means an absolutely trivial impact upon the rate of economic growth. Okay, now he made those numbers up. I could say he pulled them out of his ass, but that'd be too complimentary. Okay. Okay. He literally assumed that what happens with temperature across space happens across time. So you look at the range of temperatures in America, and you see that you're going to, Nebraska's cold and got a low GDP, and New York is temperate and has a high GDP, and then Florida's warm and has got a low GDP. You can literally draw a parabola linking those three cities. And what it basically tells you, well, you know, if temperature rises, you know, 20 degrees from, you know, 13 degrees to 33, GDP will fall by 10 or 20%. And if it goes the other direction, it'll fall by the same if it gets colder. But that means huge change in temperature are necessary to cause small changes in GDP. Okay? Now, that's true across the planet, across the space at the moment, because Alaska can, one of the reasons it works is Alaska can export to Florida and vice versa. So part of the income Alaska earns now comes from Florida and vice versa, because you can trade across time, across space. Now, we don't have time ships. You can't trade across time. Okay. But they've used the data they got out of trade across space to say that that's going to apply through time as well. And so they're telling us that, you know, 3 degrees of warming might reduce the rate of economic growth by literally about 0.1% of GDP, 0.1% per annum. So the economists have literally told politicians, not, they haven't used the right words as I'm doing right now, but they've told politicians that, well, you know, 3 degrees of global warming reduce the rate of economic growth by, let's say, 0.1%. So, you know, go out there and show that you get the greenie vote by saying you're really worried about global warming, you're going to do something, but it doesn't really matter. Ignore it, okay? That's what the politicians have swallowed. That is even wronger, even more wrong than the advice they're following about what's happening with oil and gas today. So with 3 degrees of global warming, could be enough to eliminate civilization.
Wow.
And the timing is not 100 or 200 years in advance. The most serious worries climate scientists have in the next 10 or 20 years. So it's going to happen in your lifetime, might even happen in my lifetime. That's the main thing I worry about. And I'm writing a book with the working title of the book is How Economists Will Destroy Capitalism.
When does that come out?
I've got to finish it by June, July. I put it off to write a book on money and macroeconomics for Elon Musk, for engineers, as a way to get through to him, say, stop listening to economists and start thinking like an engineer about the economy and you'll be more realistic. He hasn't read it. Of course, he probably never will. But writing that took me a while, so I put off this book and now I'm back to trying to working on it full time. So with luck, I'll finish it by June, July, and it might come out by December.
Wow. So where do things go with, if things are as bad as you say, what's the inevitable?
Civilization falling apart.
If I'm as an investor, like what
the world's falling apart.
Sorry.
How do people best position themselves?
Like the thing I'm trying to get people to be aware of is just how severe this threat is and how we have to be prepared for it. Okay. So what I would want to see is large amounts of money going into what are called high cooling strategies, things which are going to could dramatically drop the temperature of the planet at relatively low cost. That's what I would rather see us focusing upon. So there's a company, there's an institution called MIR. And MIR stands for Mirrors for Earth's Energy Rebalancing, so MIR.org. They've developed a way of producing extremely cheap mirrors to reflect solar energy back into outer space before it gets a chance to get turned into infrared, which is what is our problem. So because when radiation comes from the sun, it comes in the form of high-energy photons that are in the visible light to ultraviolet range. They then interact with all sorts of stuff on the Earth, whether we make use of them or not, and they go out. Each high-energy photon goes out as 40 low-energy photons. That's what infrared is, okay? So that's what's warming us up, the fact we're capturing those low-energy ones and reflecting it back down with carbon dioxide. So the strategy that MIR is going on is saying we have to reflect that high-energy stuff back into outer space before it gets absorbed by agricultural or natural processes or industrial processes on the planet. And they reckon that this is the scale we're talking about. Every 1% of the planet's surface they could cover with these mirrors would reduce global temperature by 1 degree. So you'd need to cover 1.5% of the planet with mirrors, which is huge, but it's feasible. That's like in terms of the land area, that's about 6% of the land area of the planet. And if we do that, we can drop temperature by one by you know, several degrees. And I think we're going to need to do that, because if we don't, then that's going to kill people. There's no way out of massive deaths with this. Either everybody dies from the planet getting too hot and everything breaking down, or lots of people will die because we make it too cold and they die for that reason. This is absolutely no way to avoid massive deaths coming out of this. So I would want to see investment in those sorts of technologies. There's other techniques to sequester carbon really rapidly. Even growing bamboo is one proposal I've seen. Bamboo grows pretty damn rapidly. You can actually watch bamboo grow. You know that, don't you? It grows to up to 12 inches a day. Okay, so bamboo absorbs a huge amount of carbon dioxide that way. There's stuff with seagrass, seaweed, that absorbs, and you can process that. There are ideas to use phytoplankton, which are between a border known as the thermocline layer in the ocean, and techniques that can. We need stuff like that. We to me, this is like building Liberty ships before World War II, which we didn't do, of course. We only started building boats. You know, America started building those boats after World War II started. But if they'd been attacked, they couldn't have built them in the first place. So the reason America could do it was they weren't being hit by the Germans at the time. Now, this is hitting everybody. So if we don't have the facilities in place to produce what we need before the crisis hits, we won't be able to produce them when the crisis hits. So that's what I want to see done. And forget about making a profit. This is about enabling civilization to survive.
Yeah, that's what I meant, Professor Keane.
You want to make some money out of it, do you?
Well, this is my first, I'm hearing this for the first time, that solution to the world's problems, the greatest problems, is going to be mirrors and bamboo. So give me a minute to process this. Professor Keane, where do people find you if they want to learn more about you, your books, your thoughts?
Well, probably the best at the moment is my YouTube channel. So that's at Prof. Steve Keane on YouTube. A lot of videos go up there. I have a Patreon and a Substack, both using Prof. Steve Keane as part of my name. And I make almost all my posts there are free access. Okay, you don't have to support me. I'm trying to get the ideas out. I appreciate the support because I'm doing this on the smell of an oily rag, and I'm trying to fight, you know, Harvard and Yale who are pumping out this garbage instead. So it's a David versus Goliath struggle, and David appreciates a bit of support. But also, I now am giving online courses, and that's marketed through stevekeane.com. So if you search www.stevekeane.com, you'll find the link to my online courses. The marketing is annoying, okay? But it's real. It actually ends up being, you might think you're being spammed for a while because it is pretty heavy commercial marketing, but it does lead to courses by me. And I've got well over 1,000 people who've signed up now, and I give 12 hours of a week of lectures on that as well in three different streams. So, so back to summarize again, YouTube, Patreon, Substack with Prof. Steve Keane, and then an online course at stevekeane.com.
Awesome. We'll put those in the YouTube channel notes. Thanks for listening, everybody. Professor Keane, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts. And everybody, stay smart, stay curious, stay disciplined. This is just Steve Yang learning alongside you from people smarter than me, like Professor Steve Keane, and I appreciate your time. Thanks, everyone.
You're welcome, Steve. Bye. Okay. All righty.